I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Plessy v. Ferguson, the 1896 law that made racial segregation legal, is considered the most infamous U.S. Supreme Court decision after Dred Scott. The court upheld a Louisiana law that mandated separate train cars for blacks and whites. Homer Plessy, a light-skinned man from New Orleans, bought a first-class ticket, and when asked by the conductor if he was white, said no. He was arrested, and his case made its way to the highest court in a decision that led to segregated housing, schools, bathrooms, water fountains, lines of credit, employment, travel, until 1954 and Brown versus the Board of Education that said separate is inherently unequal. Our guest Steve Luxenberg tells the story of Plessy v. Ferguson in his new book, Separate. He focuses on a number of key players. Plessy's lawyer, Albion Tourge, mixed race resistors in New Orleans led by Louis Martinet, Justice Henry Billings Brown, who wrote the Plessy decision, and Justice John Harlan, the lone dissenter. Steve Luxenberg is a senior editor for The Washington Post, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for asking me.
I learned a lot reading this book. One, that you say that Jim Crow laws that basically defined what blacks could do in the South really had its roots in the North. Explain that apparent discrepancy.
Well, you know, we think of the South because the South is where separation spread in the 20th century. Notice I use the word separation. Yes. Because in the 19th, they didn't use the word segregation. If you look at newspapers, that's what the word was. But in the South, before the Civil War, there was slavery. You're not separating the enslaved population from the masters, putting them on a... They didn't have many railroad cars in the South anyway, because they were lagging behind in construction. So the first separate railroads are in Massachusetts. In 1838, in near Boston, these lines, there are eight railroads. Three of them are running separate cars. Only three. So it's already a division.
Right.
Right. We're not having...
And we're talking about freed blacks in the North.
Right. Obviously. So you might think, well, there may be a lot of black passengers. And you would be wrong. The population of Massachusetts in 1840, 1% of the population were people of color. There weren't a lot of black passengers. You didn't need separate cars. In fact, many of them ran empty. But the first, the Eastern Railroad opens up in 1838, and on the first run, there's a newspaper article a month later that refers to two drunken white sailors who are behaving so badly and disgusting the other passengers that they are banished to the refuse as in trash,
right,
or Jim Crow car. And when I ran across this in my digital digging, I was astonished because I think of Jim Crow as a term that comes in the late 19th century.
Right.
But it was used as almost a second reference, as if the crew and the readers would know exactly what was being talked about.
And these cars were also called dirt cars.
Dirt cars.
Forgotten barbarians. And these were the cars where the few blacks in the North were forced to sit as they traveled by train.
Yes. And you know, this is, we have to think about the dawn of the railroad age. This is like a cell phone to us. This is new technology. And as I write in the book, there's nothing like a railroad car to throw together a mass of humanity.
Sure. No,
a stagecoach doesn't do it. It's too small. And people have to ask the question of themselves, where do I sit? And some railroad companies thought their white passengers, they weren't too concerned about their black passengers, would want to sit only with white people.
You describe, and it's interesting, Frederick Douglass makes several appearances in this story, not surprisingly, and he describes being dragged off. Obviously, he was trying to sit in the white car on this train, being dragged off, holding on to the seat while six men pulled him off the train.
And he's holding on so tightly, he claims that he rips the seat off of its hinges or bolts, which may or may not be quite true.
Right.
But here's the situation. This is a political fight, as it often is. Frederick Douglass isn't on the train as just any old passenger. He is the newest agent of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. He is riding in company with a white abolitionist, and they are going to the meetings of the chapters of the society. And like a lot of our listeners, I suspect, when you go to your night meetings through bad weather, how had the abolitionists been going to their meetings before? Well, they've been going on horseback. So they were thrilled to be on trains. And the conductors were not thrilled. on the Eastern Railroad to see Mr. Douglas in company of a white abolitionist. Mm-hmm. So he ordered Douglas to the refuse car, the dirt car, the Jim Crow car. And the white abolitionist said, well, I'll go with him. And the conductor says, no, you can't do that either. Well, the abolitionists were also thrilled because they needed issues. They had one. And so it didn't happen right away. This friction that we're talking about, it actually took 2 years before it began to happen, because Douglas wasn't actually a member of the society's employee staff until 1841. But once they had the issue, they wouldn't let it go.
Well, let's fast forward even past the Civil War and to the South, and actually to New Orleans, Louisiana. Louisiana had this law basically segregating its railroad cars.
Huge difference. In 1838, we have a company policy. No law. Right. Not required. Fast forward to 1890, and Louisiana is not the first state to enact a separate car, that's not a motor car, that's a rail car, separate car statute. They were preceded by first Florida, then Mississippi, but those statutes were all slightly different. And what this statute in Louisiana did in 1890, which the committee that actually brings this case of mixed-race, French-speaking Creoles, Creole being the word for native-born,
right.
What they have protested this law at the legislature. They went to lobby, just like people lobby today. They didn't succeed, and they decide they're going to bring a test case. But what the legislature said, this is in the preamble, is that trains running in the state must have separate, equal but separate cars. Equal but separate
cars.
Cars for white and colored passengers. Not separate but equal cars. It just happens to be a little different phraseology.
Well, you describe, New Orleans is kind of a world unto itself even today, but you describe New Orleans after the Civil War, and it was a place of a lot of mixed race people, and also it seemed like a hotbed of resistors as well.
Well, New Orleans is, as you say, unlike any city in the country then, certainly. Mardi Gras makes it unlike any city in the country now. But New Orleans was, when the American takeover occurred in 1803, the provisional governor, a guy from Virginia, arrives. Mm-hmm. And he, to his astonishment, finds that he has 6,000 people, free people of color. Free people of color. And not only are they free under the French and Spanish regimes that had preceded the Americans, but they have a militia and they have weapons. And he writes to James Madison, the Secretary of State, and he says, I got a problem down here. Takes a month for his letter to get there. Takes a month for it to get back. And Madison's answer, like many answers today, is, you're on your own, buddy. I can't direct you from up here in Washington. It would take too long. I wouldn't know what to say. I'm not there. You've got the boots on the ground. And he muddles through. He does not disband the militia. He kind of lets them be who they are. But he is wary of them, because if other cities in the South see what's happening in New Orleans, you have the basis for some revolts. So by 1814, when General Jackson comes to New Orleans for the famous Battle of New Orleans, which is at the very end of the War of 1812, he recruits the free people of color to join his ranks because he needs their manpower. And he promises them certain rights, which they don't get. They are promised rights repeatedly throughout the century. And by 1890, they're tired of being promised their rights and not getting them.
In fact, you write that the Emancipation Proclamation did not apply to blacks living in New Orleans?
It did not apply to the enslaved population.
To the enslaved population.
Which, of course, this group wasn't.
Right.
They were the sandwich layer, I call them, between the white population and the enslaved population. But Lincoln changed the draft of the proclamation from September of 1862 to January of 1863 against the wishes of his cabinet to exclude New Orleans and all of the counties along the Mississippi River, which were held by federal troops. And he excluded them because he wanted to be consistent. He was saying to the South, I'm not ending slavery here. I'm preventing you from using the enslaved population to defeat the Union Army. That's what he said he was doing. Now, you can argue about whether that's what he was really doing, but he was trying to be consistent. Well, that creates chaos in New Orleans, because you have people streaming into New Orleans who are free in other parts of the state, because the Emancipation Proclamation, we should remind our listeners, only applied to the states in rebellion. It did not apply to a slave in Kentucky, where, because Kentucky had never joined the Confederacy. So in the state where the dissenting justice will come from, John Marshall Harlan, his state, the slave system went on, including in his own family.
Yeah. Let me put a couple of more New Orleans things on the table here. As you said, Louisiana passes a separate car act. Then a committee, I love this name, the Citizens Committee to Test the Constitutionality of the Separate Car Law is organized. There's a guy named Martinet who's involved in this. And eventually there's a young man named Homer Plessy, who's really the person who defies the law. What do we need to know about him? And I know he was light-skinned. Was that sort of his main reason that they chose him?
It was probably the only reason they
chose him. Really? Was he? I was wondering whether he had any civil rights activism that he had done.
He was definitely part of that group and their political activism. But he was young. He was 29 years old. You know, the name of the committee, I laughed when I looked at it. It was on their letterhead. And I thought, well, no PR agency helped them with a logo here.
But it's a mouthful. It works. It is. But I like it.
It's straightforward. But Plessy was the second of two test cases. And the first one, which we won't go into in any detail, happened. And it didn't quite work out the way they wanted it. They actually sort of won, but it left in place separation on the railroad in Louisiana. It did not leave it in place on railroads running from other parts of the country through Louisiana. And so they needed another volunteer. And the thinking of the legal team, now these are three white lawyers working with Louis Martinet, the mixed race head of the engine of the committee. He wasn't technically the head of it. And they decided that it would benefit their argument if they could get someone who could cause confusion, as I write. He was fair-skinned enough to cause confusion. And they wanted to argue that how the heck is a conductor walking down the aisle of a train supposed to separate his passengers when there's a whole group of them that you can't tell the race unless you ask them.
Right.
And they wanted to say, well, he can't ask them because he's not a jury. He can't take testimony. He can't have due process. And so the law should be thrown out as unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment, which required that due process. And they had a very contorted legal argument, a wonderfully complex legal argument, for how your race is your reputation and you shouldn't be deprived of it without due process.
Oh, that's fascinating. And the conductor was in on it?
The conductor was in on it. I don't know if the whole train crew was in on it, but the railroad was in on it.
Right.
And why was the
railroad? For civil rights reasons or for business reasons?
I think their civil rights were not as strong as the committee's, if they existed at all. No, they're for business reasons. It was expensive to run a separate car. And as we talked about, there weren't a lot of black passengers. So if you could fit everybody into one car, why would you want to run two? Why would you want to own two? Why would you want to own a fleet? Why would you want to own a first-class car when you didn't need one? So they were looking to the future, and they were saying, well, if we don't need to do this, then we'd like to prevent it. But they also thought, they saw the reasonableness of just testing the law. It was a new law. Let's see how far it goes. And so they said, sure. Now, they made very plain to Martinet, we are not going to say this publicly. We are not going to tell anybody that we're in on this. But we're in on it.
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating, something I did not know. Plessy's lawyer is a guy named Albion Tourge.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
There are many colorful characters in this story. He is as well. What do we need to know about Tourge?
Well, there's probably no more colorful characters than Albion Tourge. He is born in Ohio on what's called the Western Reserve. Western Reserve actually was called that because it was reserved to the state of Connecticut when it was a territory, very, very distant from Connecticut. But it is a hotbed of abolitionists when Tourge is growing up in the 1850s. He is not one of them. His radicalization comes later when he serves in the Civil War, goes to the South, and he emerges from that period. The relationship with his wife, which I describe in detail in the book, is very important to him. She's more progressive than he is at the beginning.
Yes.
And she's pushing him. Like, why aren't you concerned about these issues? But Tourge emerges from the Civil War, and he decides he's going to become what is later, in a degrading way, called a carpetbagger. He's a proud carpetbagger. Yes, exactly what I am. I'm going to come down there, and I'm going to cement the revolution that the Civil War has started. He comes to believe that the North has as much to answer for as the South, because he understands the history of racial separation in the North. And he goes to North Carolina. He's basically run out of town after 15 years. Yeah. When he leaves, one newspaper calls him the most hated man in North Carolina, and they're probably right.
He was brash, as you describe him.
Most hated man in North Carolina, but in white supremacist circles, certainly.
Yes.
Not in his circles.
Right.
And he goes to the North and he writes these novels based upon his Reconstruction experience that are so popular and so critically acclaimed that they're compared to Uncle Tom's Cabin. And most people don't know them today. And the first one is called A Fool's Errand by One of the Fools.
And meaning himself.
By himself. And this comes back to haunt him later on because the newspaper, my own newspaper, The Washington Post, says when he shows up for the oral argument, he's just on another fool's errand.
Wow. And Plessy, I mean, he defies the law on this train. What happens to him after this, and even after this decision, which we will get to? But
well, the committee issued a report in 1897 after it was all over, sort of holding themselves accountable to the public. And they make clear that they don't want the first volunteer or Plessy to spend any time in jail. They were very happy to not have to pursue what's called the habeas corpus route, which is habeas corpus means you're illegally holding somebody in jail. You should let them go because it required Plessy to be in jail. And they didn't want to do that to a volunteer. But they find a way, with the help of Judge Ferguson, who rules that the act in Louisiana is constitutional, but with his help, they make it a case that hinges on an error of Judge Ferguson. So that's why it goes to the court as Plessy versus Ferguson. They're suing Ferguson for making an error. And so they get to the court, which isn't easy to do.
No.
And the strategy is brilliant, and then they throw about a kitchen sink worth of arguments against the court, and the court is overwhelmed by them and ignores most of them.
And we will get to that. Let me just throw out Frederick Douglass again. They ask him, I think, to be part of this suit having to do with integrating train cars, and he doesn't really want to be part of it.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have any letters from Douglass telling you what he's thinking in his own mind. We have Martinet's letters to Turgot saying what he feels about what Douglass has told them. And, you know, you have to think of it this way. If you are bringing a civil rights case in the 19th century, of course you want Frederick Douglass on your side. He's the most famous black man in America. But it's more than that. In 1883, Martinet happens to be a young delegate to the National Convention of Colored Men, a convention that Douglass called, that was held in Louisiana. And Martinet hears Douglass's stirring speech. I mean, it's really a stirring speech. You can read it in anthologies, saying, we cannot wait. We must act. And here Martinet is acting. He's acting, and he thinks, of course Douglass is going to be on my side. But Douglass disappoints him. Now, my best educated research guess is twofold. One, Douglass saw it as a losing case, and who wants to be on the side of a losing case? And two, these were a bunch of mixed-race people in New Orleans. That's not Douglass's constituency.
Interesting. That's Steve Luxenberg. We're talking about his new book. It's called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Steve Luxenberg. He's a senior editor at The Washington Post, and he's got a new book. It's about the story behind Plessy v. Ferguson, and the book is called Separate. A question from Hillary. She says, if they couldn't tell Plessy's race without asking him, couldn't he have lied? But the idea was to essentially challenge the law. I mean, he could have lied and said, yeah.
If he was a real passenger, he could have passed for white, and then there would have been no case. But the point was he bought a first-class ticket, and his destination was jail, not Covington, Louisiana.
Right.
He wanted to be arrested.
So this case then makes its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. What are the arguments that come from Plessy's lawyer?
Well, all the arguments are based in the 13th and 14th Amendments. And those amendments very quickly are the one that abolishes slavery and says that nobody should be in involuntary servitude. That's the 13th. The 14th is the equal protection of under the laws and citizenship rights for blacks and due process. Their job, every lawyer's job, one, is to win. So they want to choose arguments that they think might persuade the court. They look at this court and they say, a lot of white men, all white men, obviously, in the 19th century, men of property, men of privilege, men of wealth, let's make a property right argument. But they need to base it in something, and they base it in the 13th and 14th Amendment, and that's what I mentioned before about race is your property, and you shouldn't be able to have it taken away. I mean, if Plessy can pass for white, why would you not let him do that?
Sure, sure.
Now, it's not a very good argument, because if they had accepted it, what would we have? We'd have one car of white and mixed race passengers and one car of black passengers. So in my view, separation would have survived. So you might have asked, well, Turgay, are you really making a very good argument here? But he wanted the court to look again and look differently at the 14th Amendment, which the court had already said in previous civil rights cases they were not going to view expansively. That is hard, I think, for us to imagine in the 21st century. We see the 14th Amendment as a bedrock of the American Constitution, which it is today. It was not yet then. And they wanted to see the case in terms of Louisiana's powers and not the powers of Congress or the federal government to extend civil rights throughout the country. So they lose because they can't get the court to accept the 13th and 14th Amendments.
Well, Justice Henry Billings Brown, he writes the Plessy decision, and several things he says. Separation doesn't stamp the colored race with a badge of inferiority. He was trying to say, essentially trying to say separate was equal, when, of course, we know that was not the case.
Well, and those words don't even appear in his decision.
Exactly.
Later on, the court uses them in Brown, and that's why we use them today. But Billings Brown is a fascinating character to me because he comes from this abolitionist neck of Western Massachusetts. You would have thought he would have ended up as a dissenter, or at least he would have been a candidate for dissent. But no, he writes the decision. In fact, of the seven justices, it was 7-1. One justice didn't participate. Of those seven justices, six are from Northern families. So it's very much a case where the North is, I think, exhausted by the race question, and they're kind of washing their hands of what's happening in the South.
And didn't want the kind of commingling. I mean, they had these separate train cars in Massachusetts.
Exactly.
Right?
We can't know. There wasn't a poll taken of the justices to know which of them felt that whites were superior to blacks. I suspect all of them felt that way. Now, Harlan felt that way. He says so in his dissent, but he also says that makes no difference. Our Constitution is colorblind, a phrase he picked up from Turgay's brief, and there is no recognition of color when it comes to rights.
This is John Marshall Harlan. He's the lone dissenter. Now, he's an interesting fellow. He's from Kentucky. Slaveholder. He opposed the Confederacy. He also opposed the Emancipation Proclamation, opposed the 13th and 14th Amendments. He opposed the reelection of Abraham Lincoln. And yet he saw something that the other justices didn't see in this case.
Well, he's undergone a remarkable transformation in the 1860s. He ran as a pro-slavery candidate in 1859. His family had been slaveholders. They were not a big farming, slaveholding type of family. This was domestic work that they had their slaves engaged in. But Harlan, by the late 1860s, he's a political guy. He's not a judge. And he recognizes that he has no political future in the Democratic Party because it's filled with the Confederates that he had fought in the Civil War. Now, he joined the Union Army. He raised his own regiment because he wanted to preserve the Union. He felt very strongly about that. He felt equally strongly that slavery should continue.
Yeah.
So he wanted to preserve the Union as it was, the opposite of what Turgay wanted. By 1868, when he joins the Republican Party, he does so because there's nothing else for him. And there he meets Benjamin Bristow, who becomes his law partner. Now, Bristow was the U.S. attorney who was prosecuting Ku Klux Klan members for the violence that they were committing, and violence is very much an undercurrent of this story. He's prosecuting them, and I think that friendship had a great deal of effect upon Harlan. But the most important thing to say is that when he was nominated to the court in 1877, the Republicans rebelled. They said, the Northern Republicans rebelled. They said, this is the best that you can offer us, President Hayes, the new president? You're going to give us a guy from Kentucky who was a former slaveholder? And so Harlan does something extraordinary. He writes a 19-page letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee, which held no hearings in those days, and says, yes, I was pro-slavery, and I'm no longer pro-slavery, and I mean it, and it's genuine, and I am different. And he gets nominated, and he is confirmed.
It's such a fascinating story of someone's evolution, certainly on the
Which should hearten us today, shouldn't it?
Well, I think so, and I do want to get to that. He does talk about the Constitution being colorblind. In law, there can be no superior dominant ruling class of citizens, no caste system here. I mean, it's a very strong opinion, and a lone one, we should say. I'm curious about what the response back in 1896 to this law was when it was passed.
Very little. And the reason is that the newspapers and the public had become used to the civil rights decisions of the Supreme Court starting in 1883. Harlan was the only dissenter in the 1883 civil rights cases. It doesn't have a name like Plessy versus Ferguson because there were five cases consolidated. He was so worried about that dissent that he had writer's block, which his wife helped unlock with a clever little ruse that she claims is the reason why his pen flew. She gave him Justice Taney, the author of Dred Scott, gave him his inkwell.
Which used Harlan, Taney's inkwell to write his dissent for Plessy.
Well, anyway, that decision, that dissent, he had partly created a momentum for its publication because he wasn't finished with it when the court announced his decision. What they did in this case, in the civil rights cases, was overturn, declare unconstitutional, the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which is just like the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I mean, the radical Republicans in Congress, to use a term familiar today, were woke. They got it. They knew that they needed to not just have these amendments. They needed legislation to implement them. And they put that in the last clause of the 14th Amendment is Congress shall have the right to enact legislation.
Oh, interesting.
So they covered themselves with the Supreme Court. Well, it didn't work. Supreme Court said this law is too expansive. It applies beyond states to individuals and companies. We're not buying it. Well, Harlan dissented in a very ringing dissent. It was published in many, many newspapers in its entirety. It was longer than the majority decision. It took up most of a newspaper page.
Wow.
His dissent in Plessy was published nowhere.
Wow.
Not because people, they weren't interested. And newspapers in those days, now remember, this is not a Supreme Court press corps standing outside with Twitter and Instagram. They can't transmit the news immediately. And they see this case as maybe worth a third paragraph. Some newspapers put it in a headline. My newspaper did, thank God. but most newspapers didn't. And it took several decades. Several more Supreme Court decisions citing Plessy as a precedent for it to be recognized that this was really where separate but equal began.
And does it lead then to just the myriad ways that segregation was applied to housing and schools and water fountains and bathrooms and sitting in the back of the bus?
I say, it's hard to understand because it didn't. I have Google alerts. I get Plessy-related articles. They come and they say things like, the Supreme Court established the doctrine of separate but equal and made it the law of the land in the Plessy case. They did no such thing. Now, that's the effect of Plessy.
Right.
It's not wrong to say that. But they didn't do it. And I don't like reading that because I feel like it takes the rest of the country off the hook. Oh, until the Supreme Court established something, there was no separate but equal. But in fact, there had been separation for decades. The Supreme Court are followers, not leaders. They are sanctioning what the country had permitted. And I think that's a very important thing to realize.
But the subtitle of your book is The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. I mean, if we've been paying attention, we know our history and how segregation in many ways still exists today.
Absolutely does. And Harlan predicted this. I mean, he saw something that none of the other justices either saw, or if they saw it, they didn't say so, which is that this is going to spread. He did not use all of the examples that you use, but he used several of them. And he said, this ruling will one day be regarded as shameful as Dred Scott. That's pretty prescient.
Yeah, it is. As you say, and even marching then past World War II into the 1950s, it really Brown versus the Board of Education undid what Plessy did?
Well, and Turgé, when he was in the midst of his making his arguments up and making his tallies, he actually tallies up the justices, not by name, but by category, hopeless, likely, on our side. He understood that, you know, the court was changing. He knew that it wasn't going in the right direction. They weren't going to get another justice on their side. But in those days, you know, it wasn't so ideological. It was more party-driven. The president was more interested in making the senators from a state happy with a nominee than they were in packing the court with an ideology. So in Brown, the court recognized, and it was a unanimous decision, that they needed to be clear and unambiguous. And they needed to reverse something. And Plessy was the obvious case to reverse. So they say something in their decision. They, too, say that Plessy had established a doctrine. So they give us permission to view Plessy in that way. And I think they're right to view it that way, because Plessy is the precedent that, you know, court is all about precedent. We know this. We talk about it. In Plessy, they cite precedents of their own. One of them is right here in Philadelphia.
I was going to say right here in Philly. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So there was a case involving Mary Miles, a teacher who was like Homer Plessy. She wasn't a volunteer. She was a real passenger. And she wasn't going to sit in the car for black passengers. And she refused to leave the white car. And she was ejected, literally put on the side of the tracks, miles away from her destination. She wasn't even at a station. And she came to a lawyer named George Earle, E-A-R-L-E. He was of good abolitionist stock, a white lawyer. He took her case, and they fail. They go to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which is three Republicans, so three anti-slavery party Republicans, two Democrats, and they lose 4-1.
Wow.
There's only one dissenter, and that dissenter doesn't file an opinion, so we don't know what he thought. And Agnew, Daniel Agnew, the judge who writes the decision, he makes a ringing case for separation, even saying that he's against promiscuous seating.
Promiscuous seating.
Yes, promiscuous seating.
The idea that people sitting next to each other, something untoward could happen, right?
Yes, and he thinks violence is in the air, and that if you mix the races, it's perfectly appropriate not to mix them, because it's better to stop the violence before it occurs than to try to punish people afterwards.
You mentioned this earlier, that there's nothing more sort of basic than transportation. You know, if you get on a bus, you're going to share it with people. You get on a train, you're going to share it with people. And thinking about this Plessy case and that it had to do with segregated train cars, thinking about the Green Book, that blacks in the South, they had a Green Book, so they knew where it would be safe to have a motel room or to spend the night, or where they could have dinner. Thinking, obviously, Rosa Parks, you know, deciding, I am not going to sit in the back of the bus. But something about the sort of basicness of transportation makes it important.
We can't go anywhere without transportation.
Well, exactly.
We can't stay anywhere. So these basic – but, you know, you asked – Plessy opened the door. I think that's a better way to think about it, to every other state in the South to enact its own legislation. It opened the door to companies and institutions enacting policies that would separate people. Separate waiting rooms, separate bathrooms, separate water fountains. Those indelible images that we see, those black and white images, colored white. These are the images that partly drove me to write this book. I mean, when I was in my career as a journalist, I have so often edited and written stories about race. And yet, when I was looking around for a new book topic, I didn't feel I really understood it. And I felt like I needed to understand the roots of racial separation so that I could understand today's arguments over race. Because this case, I think, reverberates down through. If you look at statistics of the gap between white and black wealth, white and black housing patterns, white and black education, there's still a huge gap.
And you think Plessy helps us understand
that? I think Plessy helped create it.
Create it.
It's very difficult to catch up. I mean, President Johnson, when he gave a speech about the Voting Rights Act of 1965, he talked about a starting line. But, you know, you can remove the shackles of slavery, but you don't necessarily – you can't end all of the oppression that has happened beforehand. It has made you start way back from the starting line. So I feel like we do need to understand that this is a compelling story, I feel, that needs to be told today. And you know, it reminds us that racial progress in America is never comes swiftly or easily.
No. Or a straight line or anything related to that.
And straight lines in transportation or in race.
Well, on that note, Steve Luxenberg, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a senior editor for The Washington Post, and we've been talking about his new book called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.